you saw double. She wasn't sure what she wanted to do, except that she knew that if she fooled around for long enough, without fretting or nagging herself, she'd find out. She remembered quoting the words of the poet Keats to Lyra, and Lyra's understanding at once that that was her own state of mind when she read the alethiometer. That was what Mary had to find now. So she began by finding herself a more or less flat piece of a wood-like pine, and grinding at the surface with a piece of sandstone, no metal, no planes, until it was as flat as she could make it. That was the method the Mulefa used, and it worked well enough with time and effort. Then she visited the lacquer grove with Atal, having carefully explained what she was intending, and asked permission to take some sap. The Mulefa were happy to let her, but too busy to be concerned. With Atal's help, she drew off some of the sticky, resinous sap, and then came the long process of boiling, dissolving, boiling again, until the varnish was ready to use. The Mulefa used pads of a cottony fibre from another plant to apply it, and following the instructions of a craftsman, she laboriously painted her mirror over and over again, seeing hardly any difference each time as the layer of lacquer was so thin, but letting it cure unhurriedly and finding gradually that the thickness was building up. She painted on over 40 coats, she lost count, but by the time her lacquer had run out, the surface was at least 5 millimeters thick. After the final layer came the polishing, a whole day of rubbing the surface gently in smooth circular movements until her arms ached and her head was throbbing and she could bear the labour no more. Then she slept. Next morning the group went to work in a coppice of what they called knotwood, making sure the shoots were growing as they had been set, tightening the interweaving so that the grown sticks would be properly shaped. They valued Mary's help for this task, as she on her own could squeeze into narrower gaps than the Mulefa, and, with her double hands, work in tighter spaces. It was only when that work was done, and they had returned to the settlement, that Mary could begin to experiment, or rather to play, since she still didn't have a clear idea of what she was doing. First she tried using the lacquer sheet simply as a mirror, but for lack of a silvered back, all she could see was a doubled reflection faintly in the wood. Then she thought that what she really needed was the lacquer without the wood, but she quailed at the idea of making another sheet. How could she make it flat without a backing anyway? The idea came of simply cutting the wood away to leave the lacquer. That would take time too, but at least she had the Swiss Army knife. And she began, splitting it very delicately from the edge, taking the greatest of care not to scratch the lacquer from behind, but eventually removing most of the pine and leaving a mess of torn and splintered wood stuck immovably to the pane of clear, hard varnish. She wondered what would happen if she soaked it in water. Did the lacquer soften if it got wet?
No,
said her master in the craft.
It will remain hard forever. But why not do it like this?
And he showed her a liquid kept in a stone bowl, which would eat through any wood in only a few hours. It looked and smelled to Mary like an acid. That would hurt the lacquer hardly at all, he said, and she could repair any damage easily enough. He was intrigued by her project and helped her to swab the acid delicately onto the wood, telling her how they made it by grinding and dissolving and distilling a mineral they found at the edge of some shallow lakes she had not yet visited. Gradually the wood softened and came free, and Mary was left with a single sheet of clear brown-yellow lacquer, about the size of a page from a paperback book. She polished the reverse as highly as the top, until both were as flat and smooth as the finest mirror. And when she looked through it, nothing in particular. It was perfectly clear, but it showed her a double image, the right one quite close to the left and about 15 degrees upwards. She wondered what would happen if she looked through two pieces, one on top of the other. So she took the Swiss Army knife again and tried to score a line across the sheet so she could cut it in two. By working and reworking, and by keeping the knife sharp on a smooth stone, she managed to score a line deep enough for her to risk snapping the sheet. She laid a thin stick under the score line and pushed sharply down on the lacquer, as she'd seen a glazier cutting glass, and it worked. Now she had two sheets. She put them together and looked through. The amber colour was denser, and like a photographic filter it emphasised some colours and held back others, giving a slightly different cast to the landscape. The curious thing was that the doubleness had disappeared, and everything was single again, but there was no sign of shadows. She moved the two pieces apart, watching how the appearance of things changed as she did so. When they were about a hand span apart, a curious thing happened. The amber colouring disappeared, and everything seemed its normal colour, but brighter and more vivid. At that point, Atal came along to see what she was doing.
Can you see Sraf now?
No, but I can see other things,
Mary said, and tried to show her. Atal was interested, but politely, not with the sense of discovery that was animating Mary. And presently the Zalif tired of looking through the small pieces of lacquer and settled down on the grass to maintain her wheels and claws. Sometimes the Mulefa would groom each other's claws out of pure sociability, and once or twice Atal had invited Mary to attend to hers. Mary, in turn, let Atal tidy her hair, enjoying how the soft trunk lifted it and let it fall, stroking and massaging her scalp. She sensed that Atal wanted this now, so she put down the two pieces of lacquer and ran her hands over the astonishing smoothness of Atal's claws, that surface smoother and slicker than Teflon that rested on the lower rim of the central hole and served as a bearing when the wheel turned. The contours matched exactly, of course, and as Mary ran her hands around the inside of the wheel, she could feel no difference in texture. It was as if the Mulefa and the seed pod really were one creature, which by a miracle could disassemble itself and put itself together again. Atal was soothed, and so was Mary, by this contact. Her friend was young and unmarried, and there were no young males in this group, so she would have to marry a Zalif from outside. But contact wasn't easy, and sometimes Mary thought that Atal was anxious about her future. So she didn't begrudge the time she spent with her, and now she was happy to clean the wheel holes of all the dust and grime that accumulated there, and smooth the fragrant oil gently over her friend's claws while Atal's trunk lifted and straightened her hair. When Atal had had enough, she set herself on the wheels again and moved away to help with the evening meal. Mary turned back to her lacquer, and almost at once she made her discovery. She held the two plates a hand span apart so that they showed that clear, bright image she'd seen before, but something had happened. As she looked through, she saw a swarm of golden sparkles surrounding the form of Atal. They were only visible through one small part of the lacquer, and then Mary realized why. At that point she had touched the surface of it with her oily fingers.
Atal! Quick! Come back!
Atal turned and wheeled back.
Let me take a little oil. Just enough to put on the lacquer.
Atal willingly let her run her fingers around the wheel holes again, and watched curiously as Mary coated one of the pieces with a film of the clear, sweet substance. Then she pressed the plates together and moved them around to spread the oil evenly, and held them a hand span apart once more. And when she looked through, everything was changed. She could see shadows. If she'd been in the Jordan College retiring room, when Lord Asriel had projected the photograms he'd made with the special emulsion, she would have recognized the effect. Everywhere she looked, she could see gold, just as Atal had described it. Sparkles of light, floating and drifting and sometimes moving in a current of purpose. Among it all was the world she could see with the naked eye, the grass, the river, the trees, but wherever she saw a conscious being, one of the Mulefa, the light was thicker and more full of movement. It didn't obscure their shapes in any way. If anything, it made them clearer.
I didn't know it was beautiful,
Mary said to Atal.
Why, of course it is,
her friend replied.
It is strange to think that you couldn't see it. Look at the little one.
Atal indicated one of the small children playing in the long grass, leaping clumsily after grasshoppers, suddenly stopping to examine a leaf, falling over, scrambling up again to rush and tell his mother something, being distracted again by a piece of stick, trying to pick it up, finding ants on his trunk and hooting with agitation. There was a golden haze around him, as there was around the shelters, the fishing nets, the evening fire, stronger than theirs, though not by much. But unlike theirs, it was full of little swirling currents of intention that eddied and broke off and drifted about to disappear as new ones were born. Around his mother, on the other hand, the golden sparkles were much stronger, and the currents they moved in were more settled and powerful. She was preparing food, spreading flour on a flat stone, making the thin bread like chapatis or tortillas, watching her child at the same time. And the shadows, or the sraf, or the dust, that bathed her, looked like the very image of responsibility and wise care.
So at last you can see. Well, now you must come with me.
Mary looked at her friend in puzzlement. Atal's tone was strange. It was as if she were saying, "Finally you're ready. We've been waiting. Now things must change." And others were appearing, from over the brow of the hill, from out of their shelters, from along the river. Members of the group, but strangers too, Mulefa who were new to her, and who looked curiously towards where she was standing. The sound of their wheels on the hard-packed earth was low and steady.
"Where must I go?"
Mary said.
"Why are they all coming here?"
"Don't worry,"
said Atal.
"Come with me. We shall not hurt you."
It seemed to have been long planned, this meeting, for they all knew where to go and what to expect. There was a low mound at the edge of the village that was regular in shape and packed with hard earth, with ramps at each end, and the crowd, 50 or so at least, Mary estimated, was moving towards it. The smoke of the cooking fires hung in the evening air, and the setting sun spread its own kind of hazy gold over everything. Mary was aware of the smell of roasting corn and the warm smell of the Mulefa themselves, part oil, part warm flesh, a sweet, horse-like smell. Atal urged her towards the mound. Mary said,
"What is happening? Tell me."
"No, no, not me. Satamax will speak."
Mary didn't know the name Satamax, and the Zalif whom Atal indicated was a stranger to her. He was older than anyone she'd seen so far. At the base of his trunk was a scatter of white hairs, and he moved stiffly as if he had arthritis. The others all moved with care around him, and when Mary stole a glance through the lacquer glass, she saw why. The old Zalif's shadow cloud was so rich and complex that Mary herself felt respect, even though she knew so little of what it meant. When Satamax was ready to speak, the rest of the crowd fell silent. Mary stood close to the mound, with Atal nearby for reassurance. But she sensed all their eyes on her and felt as if she were a new girl at school. Satamax began to speak. His voice was deep, the tones rich and varied, the gestures of his trunk low and graceful.
"We have all come together to greet the stranger, Mary. Those of us who know her have reason to be grateful for her activities since she arrived among us. We have waited until she had some command of our language. With the help of many of us, but especially the Zalif Atal, the stranger Mary can now understand us. But there was another thing she had to understand, and that was Shraf. She knew about it, but she could not see it as we can, until she made an instrument to look through. And now she has succeeded. She is ready to learn more about what she must do to help us. Mary, come here and join me."
Mary felt dizzy, self-conscious, bemused, but she did as she had to and stepped up beside the old Zalif. She thought she had better speak, so she began.
"You have all made me feel I am a friend. You are kind and hospitable. I came from a world where life is very different, but some of us are aware of Thraf, as you are, and I'm grateful for your help in making this glass through which I can see it. If there is any way in which I can help you, I will be glad to do it."
She spoke more awkwardly than she did with Atal, and she was afraid she hadn't made her meaning clear. It was hard to know where to face when you had to gesture as well as speak, but they seemed to understand. Satamax said,
"It is good to hear you speak. We hope you will be able to help us. If not, I cannot see how we will survive. The Tualapi will kill us all. There are more of them than there ever were, and their numbers are increasing every year. Something has gone wrong with the world. For most of the 33,000 years, but there have been Mulefa. We have taken care of the earth. Everything balanced. The trees prospered, the grazers were healthy, and even if once in a while the Tualapi came, our numbers and theirs remained constant. But 300 years ago, the trees began to sicken. We watched them anxiously, and tended them with care, and still we found them producing fewer seed pods, and dropping their leaves out of season, and some of them died outright, which had never been known. All our memory could not find a cause for this. To be sure, the process was slow, but so is the rhythm of our lives. We did not know that until you came. We have seen butterflies and birds, but they have no srath. You do. Strange as you seem, but you are swift and immediate, like birds, like butterflies. You realize there is a need for something to help you see srath, and instantly, out of the materials we have known for thousands of years, you put together an instrument to do so. Beside us, you think and act with the speed of a bird. That is how it seems, which is how we know that our rhythm seems slow to you. But that fact is our hope. You can see things that we cannot. You can see connections and possibilities and alternatives that are invisible to us, just as Srath was invisible to you. And while we cannot see a way to survive, we hope that you may. We hope that you will go swiftly to the cause of the tree's sickness and find a cure. We hope you will invent a means of dealing with the Tualapi, who are so numerous and so powerful. And we hope you can do so soon, or we shall all die.
There was a murmur of agreement and approval from the crowd. They were all looking at Mary, and she felt more than ever like the new pupil at a school where they had high expectations of her. She also felt a strange flattery. The idea of herself as swift and darting and bird-like was new and pleasant, because she had always thought of herself as dogged and plodding. But along with that came the feeling that they'd got it terribly wrong if they saw her like that. They didn't understand at all. She couldn't possibly fulfill this desperate hope of theirs. But equally, she must. They were waiting.
Satamax, Mulefa, you put your trust in me, and I shall do my best. You have been kind, and your life is good and beautiful, and I will try very hard to help you. And now I have seen Srath, I know what it is that I'm doing. Thank you for trusting me.
They nodded and murmured and stroked her with their trunks as she stepped down. She was daunted by what she had agreed to do. At that very moment in the world of Chitagatse, the assassin priest Father Gomez was making his way up a rough track in the mountains between the twisted trunks of olive trees. The evening light slanted through the silvery leaves, and the air was full of the noise of crickets and cicadas. Ahead of him he could see a little farmhouse sheltered among vines, where a goat bleated and a spring trickled down through the grey rocks. There was an old man attending to some task beside the house, and an old woman leading the goat towards a stool and a bucket. In the village, some way behind, they had told him that the woman he was following had passed this way, and that she talked of going up into the mountains. Perhaps this old couple had seen her. At least there might be cheese and olives to buy and spring water to drink. Father Gomez was quite used to living frugally, and there was plenty of time. Chapter 18. The Suburbs of the Dead.
Oh, that it were possible we might but hold some 2 days' conference with the dead. John Webster.
Lyra was awake before dawn, with Pantalaimon shivering at her breast, and she got up to walk about and warm herself up as the grey light seeped into the sky. She had never known such silence, not even in the snow-blanketed Arctic. There was not a stir of wind, and the sea was so still that not the tiniest ripple broke on the sand. The world seemed suspended between breathing in and breathing out. Will lay curled up fast asleep, with his head on the rucksack to protect the knife. The cloak had fallen off his shoulder, and she tucked it around him, pretending that she was taking care to avoid his demon, and that she had the form of a cat curled up just as he was. She must be here somewhere, Lyra thought. Carrying the still sleepy Pantalaimon, she walked away from Will and sat down on the slope of a sand dune a little way off, so their voices wouldn't wake him.
"Those little people,"
Pantalaimon said.
"I don't like them. I think we should get away from them as soon as we can. I reckon if we trap them in a net or something, Will can cut through and close up, and that's it, we'll be free."
"We haven't got a net or something. Anyway, I bet they're cleverer than that. He's watching us now."
Pantalaimon was a hawk as he said that, and his eyes were keener than hers. The darkness of the sky was turning, minute by minute, into the palest ethereal blue, and as she looked across the sand, the first edge of the sun just cleared the rim of the sea, dazzling her. Because she was on the slope of the dune, the light reached her a few seconds before it touched the beach, and she watched it flow around her and along towards Will. And then she saw the hand-high figure of the Chevalier Tialis, standing by Will's head, clear and wide awake, and watching them.
"The thing is, they can't make us do what they want. They got to follow us. I bet they're fed up."
"If they got hold of us,"
said Pantalaimon, meaning him and Lyra,
"and got their stings ready to stick in us, Will would have to do what they said."
Lyra thought about it. She remembered vividly the horrible scream of pain from Mrs. Coulter, the eye-rolling convulsions, the ghastly lolling drool of the golden monkey as the poison entered her bloodstream. And that was only a scratch, as her mother had recently been reminded elsewhere. Will would have to give in and do what they wanted.
"Suppose they thought he wouldn't, though. Suppose they thought he was so cold-hearted he'd just watch us die. Maybe he better make them think that, if he can."
She had brought the alethiometer with her, and now that it was light enough to see, she took the beloved instrument out and laid it on its black velvet cloth in her lap. Little by little, Lyra drifted into that trance in which the many layers of meaning were clear to her, and where she could sense intricate webs of connectedness between them all. As her fingers found the symbols, her mind found the words, "How can we get rid of the spies?" Then the needle began to dart this way and that, almost too fast to see, and some part of Lyra's awareness counted the swings and the stops and saw at once the meaning of what the movement said. It told her, "Do not try, because your lives depend on them." That was a surprise and not a happy one. But she went on and asked, "How can we get to the land of the dead?" The answer came, "Go down. Follow the knife. Go onwards. Follow the knife." And finally she asked hesitantly, half ashamed, "Is this the right thing to do?" "Yes," said the alethiometer instantly. "Yes." She sighed, coming out of her trance, and tucked the hair behind her ears, feeling the first warmth of the sun on her face and shoulders. There were sounds in the world now, too. Insects were stirring, and a very slight breeze was rustling the dry grass stems growing higher up the dune. She put the alethiometer away and wandered back to Will, with Pantalaimon as large as he could make himself, and lion-shaped, in the hope of daunting the Gallivespians. The man was using his lodestone apparatus, and when he'd finished, Lyra said,
"You've been talking to Lord Asriel?"
"To his representative,"
said Tialis.
"We ain't going."
"That's what I told him."
"What did he say?"
"That was for my ears, not yours."
"Suit yourself. Are you married to that lady?"
"No. We are colleagues."
"Have you got any children?"
"No."
Tialis continued to pack the lodestone resonator away, and as he did so, the Lady Salmakia woke up nearby, sitting up graceful and slow from the little hollow she'd made in the soft sand. The dragonflies were still asleep, tethered with cobweb-thin cord, their wings damp with dew.
"Are there big people on your world? Or are they all small like you?"
We know how to deal with big people,
Tialis replied, not very helpfully, and went to talk quietly to the lady. They spoke too softly for Lyra to hear, but she enjoyed watching them sip dewdrops from the marum grass to refresh themselves. Water must be different for them, she thought to Pantalaimon. Imagine drops the size of your fist. They'd be hard to get into. They'd have a sort of elastic rind, like a balloon. By this time, Will was waking too, wearily. The first thing he did was to look for the Gallivespians, who looked back at once, fully focused on him. He looked away and found Lyra.
I want to tell you something,
she said.
Come over here, away from...
If you go away from us, you must leave the knife. If you won't leave the knife, you must talk to each other here.
Can't we be private? We don't want you listening to what we say.
Then go away, but leave the knife.
There was no one else nearby, after all, and certainly the Gallivespians wouldn't be able to use it. Will rummaged in the rucksack for the water bottle and a couple of biscuits, and handing one to Lyra, he went with her up the slope of the dune.
I asked the alethiometer, and it said we shouldn't try and escape from the little people, because they were going to save our lives. So maybe we're stuck with them.
Have you told them what we're going to do?
No, and I won't either, because they'll only tell Lord Asriel on that speaking fiddle, and he'd go there and stop us. So we got to just go and not talk about it in front of them.
They are spies, though. They must be good at listening and hiding. So maybe we better not mention it at all. We know where we're going, so we'll just go and not talk about it, and they'll have to put up with it and come along.
They can't hear us now. They're too far off. Will, I asked how we'd get there, too. It said to follow the knife. Just that.
Sounds easy, but I bet it isn't. Do you know what Yorick told me?
No. He said, when I went to say goodbye, he said it would be very difficult for you. But he thought you could do it. But he never told me why.
The knife broke because I thought of my mother. So, I've got to put her out of my mind. But it's like when someone says, don't think about a crocodile. You do. You can't help it.
Well, you cut through last night, all right.
Yeah, because I was tired, I think. Well, we'll see. Just follow the knife.
That's all it said.
Might as well go now, then. Except there's not much food left. We ought to find something to take with us. Bread and fruit or something. So first I'll find a world where we can get food, and then we'll start looking properly.
All right,
said Lyra, quite happy to be moving again, with Pan and Will alive and awake. They made their way back to the spies, who were sitting alertly by the knife, packs on their backs.
We should like to know what you intend,
said Selmakia.
Well, we're not coming to Lord Asriel anyway,
said Will.
We've got something else to do first.
And will you tell us what that is, since it's clear we can't stop you from doing it?
No, because you just go and tell them. You'll have to come along without knowing where we're going. Of course, you could always give up and go back to them.
Certainly not,
said Tialis.
We want some kind of guarantee. You're spies, so you're bound to be dishonest. That's your trade. We need to know we can trust you. Last night we were all too tired and we couldn't think about it. But there'd be nothing to stop you waiting till we were asleep and then stinging us to make us helpless and calling up Lord Asriel on that lodestone thing. You could do that easily. So we need to have a proper guarantee that you won't. A promise isn't enough.
The two Gallivespians trembled with anger at this slur on their honour. Tialis, controlling himself, said,
We don't accept one-sided demands. You must give something in exchange. You must tell us what your intentions are. And then I shall give the lodestone resonator into your care. You must let me have it when I want to send a message, but you will always know when that happens, and we shall not be able to use it without your agreement. That will be our guarantee. And now you tell us where you are going and why.
Will and Lyra exchanged a glance to confirm it.
All right, that's fair. So here's where we're going. We're going to the world of the dead. We don't know where it is, but the knife will find it. That's what we're going to do.
The two spies were looking at her with open-mouthed incredulity. Then Selmakia blinked and said,
What you say doesn't make sense. The dead are dead, that's all. There is no world of the dead.
I thought that was true as well, but now I'm not sure. At least with the knife we can find out.
But why?
Lyra looked at Will and saw him nod.
Well, before I met Will, long before I was asleep, I led this friend into danger, and he was killed. I thought I was rescuing him, only I was making things worse. And while I was asleep, I dreamed of him, and I thought maybe I could make amends if I went where he's gone and said I was sorry. And Will wants to find his father, who died just when he found him before. See, Lord Asriel wouldn't think of that, nor would Mrs. Coulter. If we went to him, we'd have to do what he wants, and he wouldn't think of Roger at all. That's my friend who died. It wouldn't matter to him, but it matters to me, to us. So that's what we want to do.
Child, when we die, everything is over. There is no other life. You have seen death, you've seen dead bodies, and you've seen what happens to a demon when death comes. It vanishes. What else can there be to live on after that?
We're going to go and find out. And now we've told you, I'll take your resonator lodestone.
She held out her hand, and Leopard Pantalaimon stood, tail swinging slowly, to reinforce her demand. Tialis unslung the pack from his back and laid it in her palm. It was surprisingly heavy, no burden for her, of course, but she marvelled at his strength.
And how long do you think this expedition will take?
Said the Chevalier.
We don't know. We don't know anything about it, any more than you do. We'll just go there and see.
First thing, we've got to get some water, and some more food, something easy to carry. So I'm going to find a world where we can do that, and then we'll set off.
Dialis and Salmakia mounted their dragonflies and held them, quivering on the ground. The great insects were eager for flight, but the command of their riders was absolute, and Lyra, watching them in daylight for the first time, saw the extraordinary fineness of the grey silk reins, the silvery stirrups, the tiny saddles. Will took the knife, and a powerful temptation made him feel for the touch of his own world. He had the credit card still. He could buy familiar food. He could even telephone Mrs. Cooper and ask for news of his mother. The knife jarred with a sound like a nail being drawn along rough stone, and his heart nearly stopped. If he broke the blade again, it would be the end. After a few moments, he tried again. Instead of trying not to think of his mother, he said to himself, "Yes, I know she's there, but I'm just going to look away while I do this." And that time it worked. He found a new world and slid the knife along to make an opening, and a few moments later all of them were standing in what looked like a neat and prosperous farmyard in some northern country like Holland or Denmark, where the stone-flagged yard was swept and clean, and a row of stable doors stood open. The sun shone down through a hazy sky, and there was the smell of burning in the air, as well as something less pleasant. There was no sound of human life, though a loud buzzing, so active and vigorous that it sounded like a machine, came from the stables. Lyra went and looked, and came back at once, looking pale.
"There's four..."
She gulped, hand to her throat, and recovered.
"Four dead horses in there, and millions of flies."
"Look, or maybe better not."
He was pointing at the raspberry canes that edged the kitchen garden. He'd just seen a man's legs, one with a shoe on and one without, protruding from the thickest part of the bushes. Lyra didn't want to look, but Will went to see if the man was still alive and needed help. He came back, shaking his head, looking uneasy. The two spies were already at the farmhouse door, which was ajar. Dialis darted back and said,
"It smells sweeter in there."
And then he flew back over the threshold while Salmakia scouted further around the outbuildings. Will followed the Chevalier. He found himself in a big square kitchen, an old-fashioned place with white china on a wooden dresser and a scrubbed pine table and a hearth where a black kettle stood cold. Next door there was a pantry with two shelves full of apples that filled the whole room with fragrance. The silence was oppressive.
"Will, is this the world of the dead?"
The same thought had occurred to him, but he said,
"No, I don't think so. It's one we haven't been in before. Look, we'll load up with as much as we can carry. There's sort of rye bread. That'll be good, it's light. And here's some cheese."
When they had taken what they could carry, Will dropped a gold coin into the drawer in the big pine table.
"Well,"
said Lyra, seeing Tialis raise his eyebrows.
You should always pay for what you take.
At that moment, Salmakia came in through the back door, landing her dragonfly on the table in a shimmer of electric blue.
There are men coming, on foot with weapons. They're only a few minutes' walk away, and there is a village burning beyond the fields.
And as she spoke, they could hear the sound of boots on gravel, and a voice issuing orders, and the jingle of metal.
Then we should go,
said Will. He felt in the air with the knife point, and at once he was aware of a new kind of sensation. The blade seemed to be sliding along a very smooth surface like a mirror, and then it sank through slowly until he was able to cut. But it was resistant, like heavy cloth, and when he made an opening he blinked with surprise and alarm, because the world he was opening into was the same in every detail as the one they were already standing in.
"What's happening?"
said Lyra. The spies were looking through, puzzled, but it was more than puzzlement they felt. Just as the air had resisted the knife, so something in this opening resisted their going through. Will had to push against something invisible, and then pull Lyra after him, and the Gallivespians could hardly make any headway at all. They had to perch the dragonflies on the children's hands, and even then it was like pulling them against a pressure in the air. Their filmy wings bent and twisted, and the little riders had to stroke their mounts' heads and whisper to calm their fears. But after a few seconds of struggle, they were all through, and Will found the edge of the window, though it was impossible to see, and closed it, shutting the sound of the soldiers away in their own world.
Will,
said Lyra, and he turned to see that there was another figure in the kitchen with them. His heart jolted. It was the man he'd seen not 10 minutes before, stark dead in the bushes with his throat cut. He was middle-aged, lean, with the look of a man who spent most of the time in the open air. But now he was looking almost crazed or paralyzed with shock. His eyes were so wide that the white showed all around the iris, and he was clutching the edge of the table with a trembling hand. His throat, Will was glad to see, was intact. He opened his mouth to speak, but no words came out. All he could do was point at Will and Lyra.
"Excuse us for being in your house, but we had to escape from the men who were coming. I'm sorry if we startled you. I'm Lyra, and this is Will. And these are our friends, the Chevalier Tialis and the Lady Salmakia. Could you tell us your name and where we are?"
This normal-sounding request seemed to bring the man to his senses, and a shudder passed over him, as if he were waking from a dream.
"I'm dead. I'm lying out there dead. I know I am. You ain't dead. What's happening? God help me. They cut my throat. What's happening?"
Lyra stepped closer to Will when the man said, "I'm dead," and Pantalaimon fled to her breast as a mouse. As for the Gallivespians, they were trying to control their dragonflies, because the great insects seemed to have an aversion for the man, and darted here and there in the kitchen, looking for a way out. But the man didn't notice them. He was still trying to understand what had happened.
"Are you a ghost?"
The man reached out his hand, and Will tried to take it, but his fingers closed on the air. A tingle of cold was all he felt. When he saw it happen, the man looked at his own hand, appalled. The numbness was beginning to wear off, and he could feel the pity of his state.
"Truly, I am dead. I'm dead, and I'm going to hell."
"Hush. We'll go together. What's your name?"
Dirk Jensen, I was. But already I don't know what to do. Don't know where to go."
Will opened the door. The barnyard looked the same, the kitchen garden was unchanged, the same hazy sun shone down. And there was the man's body, untouched. A little groan broke from Dirk Jansen's throat, as if there were no denying it any more. The dragonflies darted out of the door and skimmed over the ground and then shot up high, faster than birds. The man was looking around helplessly, raising his hands, lowering them again, uttering little cries.
"I can't stay here. Can't stay. But this ain't the farm I knew. This is wrong. I got to go."
"Oh, where are you going, Mr. Jansen?"
"Down the road. Don't know. Got to go. Can't stay here."
Salmakia flew down to perch on Lyra's hand. The dragonfly's little claws pricked as the lady said,
There are people walking from the village. People like this man, all walking in the same direction.
Then we'll go with them,
said Will, and swung his rucksack over his shoulder. Dirk Jansen was already passing his own body, averting his eyes. He looked almost as if he were drunk, stopping, moving on, wandering to left and right, stumbling over little ruts and stones on the path his living feet had known so well. Lyra came after Will, and Pantalaimon became a kestrel and flew up as high as he could, making Lyra gasp.
They're right,
he said when he came down.
There's lines of people all coming from the village. Dead people.
And soon they saw them too. 20 or so men, women and children, all moving as Dirk Jansen had done, uncertain and shocked. The village was half a mile away, and the people were coming towards them, close together in the middle of the road. When Dirk Jansen saw the other ghosts, he broke into a stumbling run, and they held out their hands to greet him.
Even if they don't know where they're going, they're all going there together. We better just go with them.
Do you think they had demons in this world?
Can't tell. If you saw one of them in your world, would you know he was a ghost?
It's hard to say. They don't look normal exactly. There was a man I used to see in my town, and he used to walk about outside the shops always holding the same old plastic bag. And he never spoke to anyone nor went inside, and no one ever looked at him. I used to pretend he was a ghost. They look a bit like him. Maybe my world's full of ghosts, and I never knew.
I don't think mine is.
Anyway, this must be the world of the dead. These people have just been killed. Those soldiers must have done it. And here they are. And it's just like the world they were alive in. I thought it'd be a lot different.
Will, it's fading. Look.
She was clutching his arm. He stopped and looked around, and she was right. Not long before he had found the window in Oxford and stepped through into the other world of Chitagatse, there had been an eclipse of the sun, and like millions of others, Will had stood outside at midday and watched as the bright daylight faded and dimmed until a sort of eerie twilight covered the houses, the trees, the park. Everything was just as clear as in full daylight, but there was less light to see it by, as if all the strength were draining out of a dying sun. What was happening now was like that, but odder, because the edges of things were losing their definition as well and becoming blurred.
It's not like going blind, even. Because it's not that we can't see things. It's like the things themselves are fading.
The colour was slowly seeping out of the world. A dim green-grey for the bright green of the trees and the grass. A dim sand-grey for the vivid yellow of a field of corn. A dim blood-grey for the red bricks of a neat farmhouse. The people themselves, closer now, had begun to notice, too, and were pointing and holding one another's arms for reassurance. The only bright things in the whole landscape were the brilliant red and yellow and electric blue of the dragonflies, and their little riders, and Will and Lyra, and Pantalaimon, who was hovering kestrel-shaped close above. They were close to the first of the people now, and it was clear they were all ghosts. Will and Lyra took a step towards each other, but there was nothing to fear, for the ghosts were far more afraid of them and were hanging back, unwilling to approach. Will called out,
"Don't be afraid. We're not going to hurt you. Where are you going?"
They looked at the oldest man among them, as if he were their guide.
"We're going where all the others go. Seems as if I know, but I can't remember learning it. Seems as if it's along the road. We'll know it when we get there."
"Mama,"
said a child.
"Why is it getting dark in the daytime?"
"Hush, dear, don't fret,"
the mother said.
"Can't make anything better by fretting. We're dead, I expect."
"But where are we going? I don't want to be dead, Mama."
"We're going to see Grandpa."
But the child wouldn't be consoled and wept bitterly. Others in the group looked at the mother with sympathy or annoyance, but there was nothing they could do to help, and they all walked on disconsolately through the fading landscape as the child's thin cries went on and on. And on. The Chevalier Tialis had spoken to Salmakia before skimming ahead, and Will and Lyra watched the dragonfly with eyes greedy for its brightness and vigour as it got smaller and smaller. The lady flew down and perched her insect on Will's hand.
"The Chevalier has gone to see what's ahead,"
she said.
"We think the landscape is fading because these people are forgetting it. The farther they go away from their homes, the darker it will get."
"But why do you think they're moving? If I was a ghost, I'd want to stay in the places I knew, not wander along and get lost."
They feel unhappy there,
Will said, guessing.
It's where they've just died. They're afraid of it.
No, they're pulled onward by something. Some instinct is drawing them down the road.
And indeed the ghosts were moving more purposefully now that they were out of sight of their own village. The sky was as dark as if a mighty storm were threatening, but there was none of the electric tension that comes ahead of a storm. The ghosts walked on steadily, and the road ran straight ahead across a landscape that was almost featureless. From time to time, one of them would glance at Will or Lyra, or at the brilliant dragonfly and its rider, as if they were curious. Finally, the oldest man said,
You, boy and girl. You ain't dead. You ain't ghosts. What you coming along here for?
We came through by accident,
Lyra told him before Will could speak.
I don't know how it happened. We were trying to escape from those men, and we just seemed to find ourselves here.
How will you know when you've got to the place where you've got to go?
I expect we'll be told. They'll separate out the sinners and the righteous, I dare say. It's no good praying now. It's too late for that. You should have done that when you were alive. No use now.
It was quite clear which group he expected to be in, and quite clear, too, that he thought it wouldn't be a big one. The other ghosts heard him uneasily, but he was all the guidance they had, so they followed without arguing. And on they walked, trudging in silence under a sky that had finally darkened to a dull iron grey, and remained there without getting any darker. The living ones found themselves looking to their left and right, above and below, for anything that was bright or lively or joyful, and they were always disappointed until a little spark appeared ahead and raced towards them through the air. It was the Chevalier, and Salmakia urged her dragonfly ahead to meet him, with a cry of pleasure. They conferred and sped back to the children.
There's a town ahead,
said Tialis.
It looks like a refugee camp, but it's obviously been there for centuries or more. And I think there's a sea or a lake beyond it, but that's covered in mist. I could hear the cries of birds. And there are hundreds of people arriving every minute from every direction. People like these ghosts.
The ghosts themselves listened as he spoke, though without much curiosity. They seemed to have settled into a dull trance, and Lyra wanted to shake them, to urge them to struggle and wake up and look around for a way out.
How are we going to help these people, Will?
He couldn't even guess. As they moved on, they could see a movement on the horizon to the left and right, and ahead of them a dirty-coloured smoke was rising slowly to add its darkness to the dismal air. The movement was people or ghosts. In lines or pairs or groups or alone, but all empty-handed, hundreds and thousands of men and women and children were drifting over the plain towards the source of the smoke. The ground was sloping downwards now and becoming more and more like a rubbish dump. The air was heavy and full of smoke, and of other smells besides. Acrid chemicals, decaying vegetable matter, sewage. And the further down they went, the worse it got. There was not a patch of clean soil in sight, and the only plants growing anywhere were rank weeds and coarse greyish grass. Ahead of them, above the water, was the mist. It rose like a cliff to merge with the gloomy sky, and from somewhere inside it came those bird cries that Tialis had referred to. Between the waste heaps and the mist, there lay the first town of the dead. Chapter 19. Lyra and Her Death.
I was angry with my friend. I told my wrath. My wrath did end. William Blake.
Here and there, fires had been lit among the ruins. The town was a jumble, with no streets, no squares, and no open spaces except where a building had fallen. A few churches or public buildings still stood above the rest, though their roofs were holed or their walls cracked, and in one case a whole portico had crumbled onto its columns. Between the shells of the stone buildings, a mazy clutter of shacks and shanties had been put together out of lengths of roofing timber, beaten-out petrol cans or biscuit tins, torn plastic sheeting, scraps of plywood or hardboard. The ghosts who had come with them were hurrying towards the town, and from every direction came more of them, so many that they looked like the grains of sand that trickled towards the hole of an hourglass. The ghosts walked straight into the squalid confusion of the town, as if they knew exactly where they were going, and Lyra and Will were about to follow them. But then they were stopped. A figure stepped out of a patched-up doorway and said,
"Wait, wait."
A dim light was glowing behind him, and it wasn't easy to make out his features, but they knew he wasn't a ghost. He was like them, alive. He was a thin man who could have been any age, dressed in a drab and tattered business suit, and he was holding a pencil and a sheaf of papers held together with a clip. The building he'd stepped out of had the look of a customs post on a rarely visited frontier.
"What is this place?"
said Will.
"And why can't we go in?"
"You're not dead. You have to wait in the holding area. Go farther along the road to the left and give these papers to the official at the gate."
"But excuse me, sir. I hope you don't mind me asking. But how can we have come this far if we ain't dead? Because this is the world of the dead, isn't it?"
"It's a suburb of the world of the dead. Sometimes the living come here by mistake, but they have to wait in the holding area before they can go on."
"Wait for how long?"
"Until they die."
Will felt his head swim. He could see Lyra was about to argue, and before she could speak, he said,
"Can you just explain what happens then? I mean, these ghosts who come here, do they stay in this town forever?"
"No, no. This is just a port of transit. They go on beyond here by boat."
"Where to?"
"That's not something I can tell you,"
said the man, and a bitter smile pulled his mouth down at the corners.
"You must move along, please. You must go to the holding area."
Will took the papers the man was holding out, and then held Lyra's arm and urged her away. The dragonflies were flying sluggishly now, and Tialis explained that they needed to rest. So they perched on Will's rucksack, and Lyra let the spies sit on her shoulders. Pantalaimon, leopard-shaped, looked up at them jealously, but he said nothing. They moved along the track, skirting the wretched shanties and the pools of sewage, and watching the never-ending stream of ghosts arriving and passing without hindrance into the town itself.
"We've got to get over the water, like the rest of them. And maybe the people in this holding place will tell us how. They don't seem to be angry anyway, or dangerous. It's strange. And these papers..."
They were simply scraps of paper torn from a notebook, with random words scribbled in pencil and crossed out. It was as if these people were playing a game and waiting to see when the travellers would challenge them or give in and laugh. And yet it all looked so real. It was getting darker and colder, and time was hard to keep track of. Lyra thought they walked for half an hour, or maybe it was twice as long. The look of the place didn't change. Finally, they reached a little wooden shack like the one they'd stopped at earlier, where a dim bulb glowed on a bare wire over the door. As they approached, a man dressed much like the other one came out, holding a piece of bread and butter in one hand, and without a word, looked at their papers and nodded. He handed them back and was about to go inside when Will said,
"Excuse me, where do we go now?"
"Go and find somewhere to stay. Just ask. Everybody's waiting, same as you."
He turned away and shut his door against the cold, and the travellers turned down into the heart of the shanty town, where the living people had to stay. It was very much like the main town, shabby little huts, repaired a dozen times, patched with scraps of plastic or corrugated iron, leaning crazily against each other over muddy alleyways. At some places, an anbaric cable looped down from a bracket and provided enough feeble current to power a naked light bulb or two strung out over the nearby huts. Most of what light there was, however, came from the fires. Their smoky glow flickered redly over the scraps and tatters of building material, as if they were the last remaining flames of a great conflagration, staying alive out of pure malice. But as Will and Lyra and the Gallivespians came closer and saw more detail, they picked out many more figures sitting in the darkness by themselves, or leaning against the walls, or gathered in small groups, talking quietly.
"Why aren't those people inside? It's cold."
"They're not people,"
said the Lady Salmakia.
"They're not even ghosts. They're something else, but I don't know what."
The travellers came to the first group of shacks, which were lit by one of those big, weak anbaric bulbs on a cable swinging slightly in the cold wind, and Will put his hand on the knife at his belt. There was a group of those people-shaped things outside, crouching on their heels and rolling dice, and when the children came near, they stood up, five of them, all men, their faces in shadow and their clothes shabby, all silent.
"What is the name of this town?"
said Will. There was no reply. Some of them took a step backwards, and all five moved a little closer together, as if they were afraid. Lyra felt her skin crawling, and all the tiny hairs on her arms standing on end, though she couldn't have said why. Inside her shirt, Pantalaimon was shivering and whispering,
"No. No. Lyra, no. Go away. Let's go back, please."
The people made no move, and finally Will shrugged and said,
"Well, good evening to you anyway,"
and moved on. They met a similar response from all the other figures they spoke to, and all the time their apprehension grew.
"Will, are they spectres? Are we grown up enough to see spectres now?"
"I don't think so. If we were, they'd attack us, but they seem to be afraid themselves. I don't know what they are."
A door opened, and light spilled out on the muddy ground. A man, a real man, a human being, stood in the doorway, watching them approach. The little cluster of figures around the door moved back a step or two as if out of respect, and they saw the man's face. Stolid, harmless, and mild.
"Who are you?"
he said.
"Travellers,"
said Will.
"We don't know where we are. What is this town?"
"This is the holding area. Have you travelled far?"
"A long way, yes, and we're tired. Could we buy some food and pay for shelter?"
The man was looking past them, into the dark, and then he came out and looked around further as if there were someone missing. Then he turned to the strange figures standing by and said,
"Did you see any death?"
They shook their heads, and the children heard a murmur of,
No.
The man turned back. Behind him, in the doorway, there were faces looking out. A woman, two young children, another man. They were all nervous and apprehensive.
"Death? We're not bringing any death."
But that fact seemed to be the very thing they were worried about, because when Will spoke, there was a soft gasp from the living people, and even the figures outside shrank away a little.
"Excuse me,"
said Lyra, stepping forward in her best polite way, as if the housekeeper of Jordan College were glaring at her.
"I couldn't help noticing, but these gentlemen here, are they dead? I'm sorry for asking if it's rude, but where we come from, it's very unusual, and we never saw anyone like them before. If I'm being impolite, I do beg your pardon. But you see, in my world, we have demons. Everyone has a demon. And we'd be shocked if we saw someone without one, just like you're shocked to see us. And now we've been travelling, Will and me, this is Will, and I'm Lyra. I've learned there are some people who don't seem to have demons, like Will doesn't. And I was scared till I found out they were just ordinary like me, really. So maybe that's why someone from your world might be just a bit sort of nervous when they see us, if you think we're different."
"Lyra and Will?"
"Yes, sir."
"Are those your demons?"
he said, pointing to the spies on her shoulder.
"No,"
said Lyra, and she was tempted to say, "They're our servants," but she felt Will would have thought that a bad idea. So she said,
"They're our friends, the Chevalier Tialis and the Lady Salmakia. Very distinguished and wise people who are travelling with us. Oh, and this is my demon,"
she said, taking Mouse Pantalaimon out of her pocket.
"You see, we're harmless. We promise we won't hurt you. And we do need food and shelter. We'll move on tomorrow, honest."
Everyone waited. The man's nervousness was soothed a little by her humble tone, and the spies had the good sense to look modest and harmless.
"Well, though it's strange, I suppose these are strange times. Come in, then. Be welcome."
The figures outside nodded. One or two of them gave little bows, and they stood aside respectfully as Will and Lyra walked into the warmth and light. The man closed the door behind them and hooked a wire over a nail to keep it shut. It was a single room, lit by a naphtha lamp on the table, and clean but shabby. The plywood walls were decorated with pictures cut from Filmstar magazines, and with a pattern made with fingerprints of soot. There was an iron stove against one wall with a clothes horse in front of it, where some dingy shirts were steaming. And on a dressing table there was a shrine of plastic flowers, seashells, coloured scent bottles, and other gaudy bits and pieces, all surrounding the picture of a jaunty skeleton with a top hat and dark glasses. The shanty was crowded. As well as the man and the woman and the two young children, there was a baby in a crib, an older man, and in one corner, in a heap of blankets, a very old woman, who was lying and watching everything with glittering eyes, her face as wrinkled as the blankets. As Lyra looked at her, she had a shock. The blankets stirred, and a very thin arm emerged in a black sleeve, and then another face, a man's, so ancient it was almost a skeleton. In fact, he looked more like the skeleton in the picture than like a living human being. And then Will, too, noticed, and all the travellers together realized that he was one of those shadowy, polite figures like the ones outside. And all of them felt as nonplussed as the man had been when he'd first seen them. In fact, all the people in the crowded little shack, all except the baby who was asleep, were at a loss for words. It was Lyra who found her voice first.
That's very kind of you. Thank you. Good evening. We're very pleased to be here. And like I said, we're sorry to have arrived without any death, if that's the normal way of things. But we won't disturb you any more than we have to. You see, we're looking for the land of the dead, and that's how we happen to come here. But we don't know where it is, or whether this is part of it, or how to get there, or what. So if you can tell us anything about it, we'll be very grateful.
The people in the shack were still staring, but Lyra's words eased the atmosphere a little, and the woman invited them to sit at the table, drawing out a bench. Will and Lyra lifted the sleeping dragonflies up to a shelf in a dark corner, where Tialis said they would rest till daylight, and then the Gallivespians joined them on the table. The woman had been preparing a dish of stew, and she peeled a couple of potatoes and cut them into it to make it go further, urging her husband to offer the travellers some other refreshment while it cooked. He brought out a bottle of clear and pungent spirit that smelled to Lyra like the Egyptian's Geneva, and the two spies accepted a glass into which they dipped little vessels of their own. Lyra would have expected the family to stare most at the Gallivespians, but their curiosity was directed just as much, she thought, at her and Will. She didn't wait long to ask why.
"You're the first people we ever saw without a death,"
said the man, whose name, they'd learned, was Peter.
"Since we come here, that is. We're like you. We come here before we was dead, by some chance or accident. We got to wait till our death tells us it's time."
"Your death tells you?"
"Yes. What we found out when we come here, though long ago for most of us, we found we all brought our deaths with us. This is where we found out. We had them all the time, and we never knew. See, everyone has a death. It goes everywhere with them, all their life long, right close by. Our deaths, they're outside, taking the air. They'll come in by and by. Granny's death, he's there with her. He's close to her. Very close."
"Doesn't it scare you, having your death close by all the time?"
"Why ever would it? If he's there, you can keep an eye on him. I'd be a lot more nervous not knowing where he was."
"And everyone has their own death."
"Why, yes. The moment you're born, your death comes into the world with you, and it's your death that takes you out."
"Ah, that's what we need to know, because we're trying to find the land of the dead, and we don't know how to get there. Where do we go then, when we die?"
"Your death taps you on the shoulder, or takes your hand and says, 'Come along with me, it's time.' It might happen when you're sick with a fever, or when you choke on a piece of dry bread, or when you fall off a high building. In the middle of your pain and travail, your death comes to you kindly and says, 'Easy now,